Well, some of you, I'm sure, are aware that we worked in West Africa as missionaries for some years. And one of the challenges that faced the church there in Ivory Coast where we worked was the influence of the prosperity gospel. And usually the message went something like this: come to Jesus if you want to prosper in life, if you want to prosper financially, if you want to remain healthy, if you want your kids to be successful and be able to support you when you retire, try Jesus. Very often guys will be brought in from the US or perhaps from another part of Africa, Nigeria or somewhere else, and they would hold these great campaigns. And I'm sure we're sympathetic and we can see the need of sound doctrine, of good teaching to be taught to these poor people. And yet, I believe tonight we don't actually need to go to a third world country to find traces of the prosperity gospel coming through. Sometimes as Christians, we can have the mistaken idea that being a Christian somehow produces smooth sailing, or at least smoother sailing. Yet as the kids were taught this week at Holiday Bible Club, being a Christian actually means traveling on a rocky road. My props are gone. On a rocky road, or perhaps a stormy sea. In fact, whether we're Christians or not, we all face trials and difficulties in life, don't we? But knowing Jesus makes all the difference in how we cope and how we process the storms that come into our lives. And Spencer was reminding us the other night in the prayer meeting that, you know, when we think of what folk go through and some of the horrendous things that folk experience and suffering and grief, we ask ourselves the question, how can people cope without Jesus? How can they cope without the gospel, without the pearl of great price? Well, the reading this evening is well known to many of us. Matthew's account of the storm on the Sea of Galilee. And I just want to say at the beginning, if we merely focused on the storm tonight, then we have missed the point. Or if we focused on the disciples and Peter, we have missed the point. In fact, I believe the key to the entire incident is found in verse 33, where we read, "Then those that were in the boat worshipped him, saying, 'Truly, you are the Son of God.'" They acknowledged his deity. And let's keep this in mind as we draw some lessons from this incident which Matthew has recorded for us. You'll find this event recorded in three of the Gospels. You'll find it in Mark chapter 6. You'll find it in John chapter 6. And also here in Matthew 14. And when we read the three accounts, it gives us a lovely picture of actually what took place there on the Sea of Galilee. Sometimes I use the illustration that in my past life, I was in Northern Ireland's police force for a few years. And when we weren't trying to protect the place against terrorists, we would do some normal police work. And that involved going out to road accidents, RTA, road traffic accidents. And sometimes there were just minor collisions. And the first thing you would do when you went to investigate, you would ask, are there any injuries? And even if there weren't any injuries, you could see guys looking quite menacingly at each other. And you say to yourself, well, there could be injuries pretty soon. But after you actually ascertained that there weren't any injuries, you would then seek to measure up the scene of the accident and then take statements. Not always on the scene. Sometimes people would come to the station afterwards, witnesses and so on. And you get perhaps three statements. And when you read those statements, even though they had seen the exact same thing, the statements would be a little different. But when you compared them, put them all together, you got a good picture of actually what had taken place. And so it is very often when we read some of these accounts in the Gospels, when we read the three accounts, we're not going to take time to do that tonight, but we get the details, don't we? And we're able to piece together something of what took place. Just to remind ourselves of what had been happening here, and in the previous verses leading up to what we read this evening, Jesus had performed the miracle which we know as the feeding of the 5,000, although that was just the men, not including the women and children. And John tells us that the people that witnessed this wanted to make Jesus king. They wanted to take him by force and, in a sense, march on Jerusalem. And of course, Jesus knew that a political solution was not the answer. And so Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go ahead of him to the other side. And on that journey, they encounter a great storm. I've entitled what I want to share with you this evening, simply Facing the Storm with Jesus. Facing the Storm with Jesus. I want us just for a moment tonight to imagine that we had a conversation with the disciples after this event, and perhaps if we asked them the question, looking back on your experience on the Sea of Galilee, what did you learn about Jesus? What lessons did you learn? What do you remember? What really struck you? What did you learn about him? I believe, first of all, they would say, well, he was in control. He was in control. Notice again in verse 22, in Matthew 14, it says, immediately Jesus made the disciples get into the boat and go on ahead of him to the other side while he dismissed the crowd. They didn't decide themselves to go on that journey. It was a command from Jesus. Actually, the word here made that Jesus made the disciples is actually very weak. It's actually much stronger. It means he actually insisted. He constrained them. He compelled them to get into the boat. In fact, some would suggest he actually forced them into the boat, in a sense, almost took them by the scruff of the neck and put them in the boat and told them to go. But there's a logical conclusion to be drawn, isn't there? They had no need to be afraid because Jesus was in control. Whatever lay ahead that night or the next morning, Jesus was in control. You see, they had been chosen, hadn't they? They'd been chosen by Jesus. Jesus had handpicked the disciples. They had been chosen by him. They had been loved by him. They had been taught by him. And now they were commanded by him to get into the boat. They were going forward in obedience to him. They hadn't decided themselves. He was in control. And as they went out to face the storm, Jesus was already there. Jesus was never taken by surprise, was he? Nothing ever happened by chance, and we see that time and time again throughout the Lord's earthly ministry. John chapter 1, for example, Jesus met with Nathanael, and Jesus said to him, behold, an Israelite indeed, in whom there is no guile. And Nathanael replied, how do you know me? Before Philip called you, you were under the fig tree, and I saw you. Jesus was already there. Another occasion, John chapter 4, that you know so well, it says Jesus had to pass through Samaria, and there he met with a Samaritan woman at the well, and he began to talk to her, and then he said in verse 16, he told her, go call your husband and come back. She replied, I have no husband. Jesus said, you're right when you say you've no husband. The fact is you had 5 husbands, and the man you have is not your husband. You see, Jesus was already there. He knew. He was in control. And actually, there in that boat on the Sea of Galilee, for the disciples, actually, there was no safer place to be than in the boat, obeying Jesus. And it's good for you and me to remind ourselves of that this evening, isn't it? Whatever situation we face, whatever storm we're going through, whatever this week holds for us, Jesus is already there. What does that mean for us? It means that as we even look at our world, we have confidence knowing that God is in control. Just the other day, I read one of the newspaper headlines where the head of MI5 has said that Islamic State are planning a mass attack on Britain. For many that will read that, they could be very, very fearful. But you and I, while we're concerned, we know that ultimately God is in control. He is already there. In our own lives, where perhaps we have unanswered questions and we perhaps wonder what the future holds, we know that He is already there. We can trust God. We can rest in Him. Romans 8, verse 28, that we know so well, all things work together for good. Those who love God, to those who are the called according to His purpose. If I could take you back to Africa for a moment again, back about 10 years or 11 years ago now, actually this month, we were evacuated as a family from Ivory Coast. We just these last few days, we've been moving house. And just last night, Rosin showed me a scrapbook or a newspaper cutting in the scrapbook about our evacuation at that time. But I remember during the days leading up to the evacuation, as missionaries, there were three different missions working there, New Tribes Mission, WEC and UFM. And as missionaries, we met each day for a time of prayer in a mission compound each evening, just before the evacuation. We weren't sure what was happening. The rebels were coming towards Yamazukro, where we were working. And there were perhaps 50 of us met together each day, and people would exchange what they had heard through the day. Some of it was helpful, some of it was unhelpful. Some would say, I've heard the rebels are getting closer, and so on. But I'll never forget what one girl said, a 16-year-old. Her parents were missionaries in Liberia. She loved the Lord, a really bright Christian, Janelle. And while a lot of people were fearful and saying, what's the embassy doing? Why are they not coming? Why can we not get out sooner? Janelle spoke up and she said this. She said, God says that all things work together for good. That means what I'm going through right now is good for me. There was silence, and that was it. That was really God speaking into the situation. Now, I don't want to minimize your storm tonight, but I just want to remind you, as I remind myself, that He is in control. He's never taken by surprise. Jesus is already there. If we were talking to the disciples, perhaps we could say, what else did you learn about Jesus? Well, He prioritized prayer. He prioritized prayer. Notice in point number two, notice in verse 23, after He had dismissed them, He went up on a mountainside by Himself to pray, and later that night, He was there alone. He prioritized prayer. At a first glance, we could be forgiven for thinking, but why on earth did Jesus not accompany the disciples into the boat? Some would suggest that the reason He forcibly ordered the disciples into the boat because they too were being influenced by the multitude and perhaps caught up in the hysteria of trying to make Him king, and Jesus had to get them offside. But why did He not accompany them? Well, time and time again in the Gospels, we see Jesus withdrawing, don't we? We see Him spending time in prayer. He needed to withdraw from the crowd, but He needed to withdraw from the disciples. He needed to get alone with God. We see something of the humanity of Jesus, perfectly God, but perfectly man. And if Jesus needed moments of solitude, how much more do we? He'd been giving out, he'd been ministering to the multitude, now he needed time alone in prayer. One of the dangers for all of us, but particularly for those of us perhaps involved in full-time Christian ministry, is that it's actually easier serving than praying. It's so easy to be so busy, isn't it? So busy up and doing. There's so much to do, but we notice that Jesus prioritized prayer. I was thinking of the incident over in Acts chapter 6. We read there of how a problem or an issue arose amongst certain widows concerning the distribution of food, and the apostles called a leaders' meeting together, the 12 of them, and they said this in Acts 6, verse 2. It said, "It would not be right for us to neglect the ministry of the word of God in order to wait on tables. Brother, choose 7 men from among you who are known to be full of the Spirit and wisdom. We will turn this responsibility over to them and will give our attention to prayer and to the ministry of the word." Notice what they did? Yeah, they recognized the importance of the issues that were there, but they delegated responsibility and they realized that their priority was to give attention to prayer and to the ministry of the word. They realized that their priority was prayer and God's word. I read a book some time ago. I think Ray actually had it on the stall. I don't know if it's there still, but it's a book called Serving Without Sinking by John Hindley. John Hindley says this: "If you ever find yourself not listening to Jesus' words in Scripture because you feel there is too much Christian service to be done, might it be because you think he needs your work more than you need his words?" The importance of spending time, those times with God in prayer and in his word. Jesus prioritized prayer. And I'm sure as Jesus withdrew to pray, he not only prayed for himself, but he prayed for the multitude that they would understand more fully who he was. That they would not just be moved by the emotion and the hysteria of the moment, but that they would fully comprehend his deity. Jesus wanted more than just a shallow commitment. It's interesting to notice the next chapter in Matthew 15. In verse 8, he says of the scribes and Pharisees, quoting Isaiah, he said, "You hypocrites, Isaiah was right when he prophesied about you. These people honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me." I'm sure he prayed for the multitude, prayed that somehow that their eyes would be opened, that they would realize who he was. He not only prayed for himself and for the multitude, but I'm sure he prayed also for the disciples as they went out to face the storm, that they too would truly grasp who he was. According to Mark's account, Mark 6, verse 48, that Jesus could actually see them. He knew their distress there from the mountain as he prayed. He could see them struggling. And I'm sure he prayed that their faith would remain strong. The Bible teaches us that even now Jesus is engaging in intercessory prayer on our behalf. Matthew 7, verse 20, or Hebrews 7, verse 25. "Therefore he is also able to save to the uttermost those who come to God through him, since he always lives to make intercession for them." Romans 8:34 says that Christ makes intercession for us. And it comforts us tonight, doesn't it, to think that Jesus, our great high priest, is praying for us. Remember Jesus said to Peter, "Simon, Satan desires to have you and to sift you as wheat, but I have prayed for you that your faith doesn't fail. Jesus was in control. He prioritized prayer. But I want you to notice also another lesson here. His timing was perfect. His timing was perfect. Notice in verse 24 it says, "And the boat was already a considerable distance from land, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against it." You know, it's difficult for you and me to imagine what the disciples went through in that storm. But they were obviously very frightened, buffeted by the waves because the wind was against them. Bear in mind, Matthew was a tax collector. And he's describing here the scene. It may not have been his comfort zone. Perhaps it would have been perhaps somewhat easier for the experienced fishermen on board. But nevertheless, this was a real storm. The wind was against them and they weren't making any progress, buffeted by the waves. They had started their journey peacefully and perhaps they'd been talking about the miracle of the loaves and fishes. Perhaps they were trying to make sense of it all. But now here they were facing a storm. Sometimes life is like that, isn't it? It's smooth sailing for a while when suddenly a storm blows up. And storms come into our lives in different ways. Unemployment, sickness, death of a loved one, perhaps disagreement between family members or tension with a work colleague. Storms come in different ways. And quite often we don't see the storm coming. It can suddenly blow up very suddenly, can't it? Suddenly we're in the middle of it. And the disciples, I'm sure, said to themselves, you know, that if only Jesus was here, if only Jesus was with us. They had witnessed Jesus at work and in so many situations. And they said to themselves, perhaps Jesus would know what to do if only he was here. I don't know about you, but sometimes I struggle to understand the Lord's timing. But it's good to remind ourselves that his delays are not his denials. We see this principle, don't we, time and time again in other miracles. For example, the story of Lazarus in John chapter 11, where Lazarus took sick and took ill they sent for Jesus. His sisters sent for Jesus. And yet before Jesus arrived, Lazarus died. And Martha said to Jesus, if you'd been here, my brother would have not died. But Jesus had already said, this sickness will not end in death. No, it's for God's glory, so that God's Son may be glorified through it. The Lord's timing was perfect. And as the disciples struggled there on the Sea of Galilee, Jesus knew exactly how much the disciples could bear. He saw them struggling. In Mark 6, 48, he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. Verse 25, Matthew 14, there in the fourth watch of the night, or that was between 3 and 6 a.m., just before dawn, Jesus went out to them walking on the lake. And when the disciples saw him walking on the lake, they were terrified. It's a ghost, they said, and cried out in fear. They actually screamed for fear. The original word there implies they were absolutely out of their minds, at their wits' end. They actually screamed with fear, thinking it was a ghost. First they were faced with a storm, now a ghost. It seemed that things had gone from bad to worse. What's happening? Have you ever felt like that? We're in the middle of a storm, hoping that things will improve, hoping that things will get better, but only to find that they deteriorate. Here were the disciples at their wits' end, weary in the storm and now terrified. But then Jesus comes. And Jesus reassures them. Verse 27, But immediately Jesus spoke to them, saying, "Take heart, it is I. Do not be afraid." His timing was perfect. That brings me to another lesson. His timing just wasn't perfect, but his word was enough. His word was enough. Notice Jesus simply spoke the word. "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." You see, it was only a word from the Lord that could reassure them. Back in Exodus, Moses received the same reassurance many years previous to that, when God called him to go to Pharaoh and asked him to let the Israelites go. Exodus 3, verse 13, it says, Moses said to God, "Suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, 'The God of your fathers has sent me to you,' and they ask me, 'What is his name?' Then what shall I tell them?" God said to Moses, "I am who I am. This is what you will say to the Israelites: I am has sent me to you." And Jesus here was saying the same thing to the disciples. It's I, the great I am. Do not be afraid. His word was enough. Sometimes there are many voices speaking into our situation and into our storms. Some can be helpful, others unhelpful. But sometimes, we just need to get alone with Him and hear His word. Hear what is God saying. Hear His word. It's I, it's me. Don't be afraid. We see Peter's desire, verse 28. "Lord, if it's you," Peter replied, "tell me to come to you in the water." Actually, there in verse 28, where Peter said, "if it's you," again is better translated, "Lord, since it's you." Peter wasn't doubting it. He's saying, "Lord, since it's you, tell me to come." He wanted to go to Jesus. He felt the irresistible drawing power of Jesus. And the Lord replied, verse 29, "Come, come." Peter got down out of the boat and walked on the water and came toward Jesus. Here was Peter. He was simply staking his whole life on one word from Jesus. The storm was still raging, but his master had said, "Come." He took Jesus at his word. J.C. Ryle, commenting on this, said, "To walk on the sea himself was a mighty miracle, but to enable a poor, weak disciple to do the same was a mightier miracle still." Jesus still says, "Come." You know how often in times of difficulty and in times of trial, God gives special grace to walk the waters with Him. Waters of trial and waters of sickness, waters of bereavement. There's consciousness, isn't there, there's a consciousness of special grace carrying us through, taking us through, walking the waters with Him. Isaiah 43, verse 2, "When you pass through the waters, I'll be with you, and through the rivers, they shall not overwhelm you. When you walk through fire, you shall not be burned, and the flame shall not consume you." The waters may appear deep, but when Jesus says, "Come," we have no need to be afraid. Verse 30, "When he saw the wind, he was afraid, and beginning to sink, he cried out, 'Lord, save me.'" Well, what happened? Peter, he got his eyes off the Lord, didn't he, and onto the storm. One of the biggest challenges in the midst of the storm is keeping our eyes on Jesus. You know, it's one thing, isn't it, perhaps when we're with Christians or when we're sharing with others about our troubles, but perhaps in the night hours when sleep doesn't come, keeping our eyes on Jesus can be a challenge. And Peter got his eyes off Jesus, but realizing he was sinking, he cried out, "Lord, save me." Peter had come to, he had come to an end of his own resources. He had come to an end of his own strength. And of course, in all that was going on, the Lord was working on Peter, wasn't he? Working on his character, working in his life. That's true in our lives too. God uses trials to mold and shape our lives. And God often has to bring us to that place, doesn't he, where we acknowledge that the problem is too big for us. It's too great. We can't sort it. Only God can. I love the words of the hymn that we sometimes sing. When we have exhausted our store of endurance, when our strength has failed ere this day is half done, when we reach the end of our hoarded resources, our Father's full giving is only begun. His love has no limit, his grace has no measure, his power no boundary known unto men. For out of his infinite riches in Jesus, he giveth and giveth and giveth again. Peter realized Jesus was the only answer. He realized he was going down and he cried, "Lord, save me." And notice verse 31. Jesus immediately reached out his hand and took hold of him. Jesus here took the initiative. Jesus immediately reached out his hand. Jesus always takes the initiative, doesn't he? And we see here that the gentleness and the graciousness of Jesus. "O you of little faith, why do you doubt?" He gently rebuked him for his little faith, but even with little faith, he reached out to Peter in his hour of great need. He didn't allow him to sink. He reached out his hand before he rebuked him. I was asking myself the question, how would I have reacted? How would you and I have reacted? You know, the Lord first of all rescued him and then rebuked him. "Oh, you have little faith." You know, sometimes our faith may seem very small and sometimes it may feel very weak and sometimes insignificant. But even when our faith is feeble and faltering, the Lord is ready to hold out his hand. Psalm 37, verse 23, "The steps of a good man are ordered by the Lord, and he delights in his way. Though he falls, he shall not be utterly cast down." Why? For the Lord upholds him with his hand. His word is enough. The disciples proved it, and many others have proved it too. Then as we close, and very briefly, I believe there's one final lesson here in the last verses that we had read for us together. Notice, don't we, that it was all about him. His word was enough, but it was all about him. Notice verse 32 and verse 33. "When they climbed into the boat, the wind died down. Then those who were in the boat worshipped him, saying, 'Truly, you are the Son of God.'" Two things happened. Well, the calm was restored, wasn't it? The wind died down. And it's good to remind ourselves that Jesus can restore calm to our troubled heart. Doesn't mean necessarily that the storm will always disappear, but we can know a deep sense of his peace and his presence even in the midst of the storm. But Jesus was glorified. Those that were in the boat worshipped him, saying, "Truly, you are the Son of God." This is actually the first time that the disciples had actually said this. The Father said it at the baptism at the River Jordan. The demons had said it on the eastern shore, but the disciples never said it before. They had seen miracle upon miracle, healings, raising the dead, casting out demons. They had heard preaching and teaching. And now they come to this monumental affirmation, "Truly, you are the Son of God. Jesus was glorified. And while they still had some way to go in their understanding, they acknowledged his deity. They were no longer captivated by the storm. They were captivated by the Savior. They worshipped him. They were taken up with him. The older we get, the more we realize this is what it's all about, isn't it? It's not about us. It's not about our storms. But it's all about him. I'd take a moment to share with you one final personal illustration. Before going overseas, Rosalind and I worked in Belfast in a little church there for 4 years, and it was quite an elderly congregation. One or two had the gift of discouragement, but the majority had the gift of encouragement. And I remember one little lady in particular that I loved to visit. She was an elderly lady, and she took very ill. She had gangrene and eventually had to have one leg amputated and then the second leg amputated. And I remember her being wheeled by her daughter into her midweek meeting in a wheelchair. And she was such an inspiration. And coming out of the door, she used to say, "William, isn't Jesus wonderful?" And she was just sitting strapped in the wheelchair. And I remember one day reading to her this account of Scripture. After she had her second leg removed in the Ulster Hospital in Dundonald, I read to her about the storm, and at the end she spoke up and she said, "You know, William, it's not about my storm, but it's about Jesus being glorified. It's about Jesus being glorified." And I believe, you know, as the disciples and as Peter, as they reflected on that early morning, I'm sure they acknowledged it was all about him. It wasn't about the storm. But it was all about Jesus. Jesus achieved what he set out to achieve that day as he sent the disciples out in the boat. They acknowledged his deity. "Truly, you are the Son of God." The journey for the disciples that day on the Galilean lake started and finished with Jesus. So it is in our journey. Philippians 1, verse 6. "And I am sure of this, that he who began a good work in you will bring it to completion at the day of Jesus Christ." Our journey too starts and finishes with Jesus. May we acknowledge his sovereignty in our lives and keep our eyes fixed upon him.